Wow. If you're looking for a conversation about the light and shade of life, the beauty and tragedy that we experience, then this week's guest will blow your socks off. I had the greatest pleasure of speaking to Clover Stroud, the journalist, the author, the podcast host, and because of Clover's unique ability, I don't know, to articulate life in the way it feels, not what happens, but the way it feels. It's a conversation that is going to absolutely penetrate your heart. And I often feel that we all avoid the tricky subjects, don't we? And we try and pull away from those things that are difficult to talk about. And speaking to Clover and understanding more about her perspective on embracing life and traveling tragedy and how you come out of the shadows, it has had a transformative effect on my soul. Her authenticity, her poetry, her ability with words, it is a thing to hold on to. And I cannot wait for you to listen to this. I know that you're going to come away from this conversation, as I did, with a new perspective. Enjoy.
Bow your head and let your eyelids close on down. Where we're going, you won't need to bring your frown.
Hi, I'm Holly Tucker, and welcome to my podcast, Conversations of Inspiration. I founded my first business, Not on the High Street, at 28, with a newborn strapped to my chest. Nearly 20 years on, he's all grown up, and I'm running my second business, Holly & Co. I've learned so much about taking risks, running a business, and some extraordinary life lessons along the way, and I know others have too. Yet despite the wealth of experience we have between us, lessons like this are often left unheard, and it can feel like we're travelling our paths alone. So I've reached out to founders and those who simply inspire me to share their hard-earned wisdom with you. My hope is that collectively, these remarkable realizations will help you on your own journey. I like to think of it as inspiration for life. If you enjoy this episode, might I ask you to share it with a friend and to like, subscribe, and review it so that together we can ignite people's passion across the UK. Now, let's begin this week's conversation of inspiration. Clover, welcome to Conversations of Inspiration. It's wonderful to see you. You're recording from where today?
Holly, it's really, really lovely to be here. I am in, when I say here, I mean I'm in Washington, D.C., where I've moved last August. And it is just particularly, it's particularly lovely to be talking to you because I miss England a lot, and I miss my friends, and I miss the conversations and the chat and the kind of English sensibility, I suppose. So it's really, yeah, it's lovely. It's a real privilege to be having this time to talk
goodness.
To you.
It's all my privilege. You're a journalist, a memoirist, you're a podcast host, and you've been described as a fearless explorer of the human heart. I mean, that is a job title. I hope you have that on a business card somewhere. I mean, can you imagine in America if you gave that out? What would they would think you're a therapist potentially.
Yeah, and also it was Elizabeth Gilbert who said that, which was and I love that idea of being somebody who really explores the heart. That's what I'm really, really interested in, is our emotions and why we do things, why we make decisions, who, you know, what career path we choose or not, who we get married to, how we cope with motherhood, how we cope with choosing not to have children. The kind of, you know, I'm really, really interested in normal people and the normal extraordinary lives that we live all the time. And that's what I'm doing in my writing, is kind of contemplating and excavating my emotional life. And I hope other people kind of find truths about their own lives there as well.
Well, it's just amazing to be talking to you. You've just said that you're living in Washington for a while. Tell me about the ups and downs. How is it stateside?
Yeah, so we moved here last August. We moved here for my husband's work. I found moving here very, I didn't expect at 48 to be moving to America. We'd been living in South Oxfordshire for like over a decade. We'd created a really lovely home there. And I realized when it became clear that we might have to move, it really made me start thinking about home and what home represents and really looking at the community in which I live and what it was about the location of our home, the feeling of our home, my connections to it, my connections to place, to memory. That became really, really strong in the kind of last year. And my most recent book, which is coming out in May, The Giant on the Skyline, is about
that sense of home. I was going to ask you, yes, tell me.
But then, so moving to America, so that book is about the decision to move or not. And I kind of felt that when we moved here, I'd have made the difficult decision. I'd have packed up the house. I'd have, you know, got the kids to their new schools in America. I left my two elder children in England at university. But actually arriving in America and creating a new life here, as we have since last August, has been bigger and harder and weirder than I had anticipated. So when you say what's America like, it's very, very, you know, we think we have a sort of familiarity with it because of watching lots of American movies and reading American novels and our shared language, but it's way more other when you get here as a English person. It's odd and stranger. And even language, I'm often the kind of nuance of the way that I speak, the emotional emphasis on something, the sense of humor is really, you know, is very, very different. I feel very homesick a lot of the time, but I can also see it as a, you know, as a kind of exciting adventure. And it's not forever. It's for sort of, you know, the next few years. And so my kids get a bit homesick and I talk to them about this is, you know, England's going to be there and home is going to be there and we will go back to it. And let's really kind of enjoy the strangeness of this. And we've just been in California and like being out there in that wild, massive, crazy landscape. We're out in the deserts. It's impossible not to be excited by that.
Yes.
You know, so it's impossible not to go, wow, this is incredible.
And I think there's something about knowing a timeline, you know, and being able to sort of maybe look at it as a period of life and adventure. I used to live in Holland when I was a child and I moved out there when I was 7. And I will always look back at that as one of the most profound moments of my life. I had to adapt to other people. I did experience things that no one at home was experiencing. And when I came back to the UK, I was far more cultured and had moved forward more than my counterparts in the same class. You know, I'd lived abroad. You know, I'd had to adapt to myself, whereas maybe they hadn't. So I would say that is quite a gift that you, whether they feel that or not, it will be quite a gift in the end.
Yes, I hope so. I mean, this morning as I was getting them off to school, they were all really, it was a bit post-holiday thing, but they were all a little bit weepy about wanting to be in England. And I think, and reminding them, being open to other people and other people's lives and other people's experiences is really, really important in life. And I really hope this experience of being away, even though they find it hard, will kind of give them a horizon expanding sense of the size of the world and of kind of humanity, actually, and the circumstances of other people's lives and the things that they do have that they're very privileged to have. And I hope an ability to kind of, you know, communicate with other people, I think, is to be able to talk, to be able to listen, to be able to inquire about other people, to be able to see things from another person's perspective and be curious about other people just seems to be, and genuinely curious, not just sort of
surface level
emotions of it. Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
But I'm hoping that this experience will help them to do that as well.
I think it will. Let me get back to you. I want to go back, and I hope it doesn't make you too homesick, because I'm going to ask you about the fact, you know, the beginning of your life, because you were born in Oxford to your parents, Rick and Charlotte, and you were one of 5 children. And at the age of 7, you moved to Wiltshire because your mum wanted to have a rural upbringing. And behind you, I can see that beautiful painting of the rolling hills. Tell me about your memories growing up in the countryside, because what I've read about it, it sounds pretty beautiful and bohemian and horses and fresh air and freedom. Mm. And we were just talking because we're similar ages, you know, having a childhood in the 80s. You know, we didn't have the political unrest and what our children are actually going through now. So it feels, or maybe we're looking back with rose-tinted glasses, but tell me about that moment in your life.
I'm incredibly lucky to have had a really, really beautiful childhood. And yeah, so we moved when it was actually on my 7th birthday that we moved to a house in Wiltshire, which was quite remote. And my sister Nell and I, who's 2 years older than me, had this childhood of kind of, and which is what Mum really, really wanted to create for us, which was rural life. And we had ponies and we walked through the grass barefoot across fields to go and meet our friends. And we rode our ponies around the villages and went and had picnics in Bluebell Woods and slept with our kittens in our beds and things. It was, so when I describe it, it does sound like kind of ridiculously idyllic. And I think that it was. It was also, it was kind of quite remote at times and it was quite threadbare at times. But my mum really loved us and she really, really, really gave me and Nell a sense of the kind of security of love and knowing that you're profoundly loved. And so we weren't bought tons of stuff. So I can remember when I got to about 14, like having a complete fit at mum and saying that like, I've never been bought any new clothes and I need some new clothes because I'm a teenage girl going to school and I'm always wearing my sister's older people's clothes. And I remember clearly going, she took me to Benetton and bought me a cardigan.
Oh, that was like Benetton really... cardigan. I remember those. Yeah, that was a great thing to have.
So it wasn't like hugely sort of consuming. And I think there is a thing of rural life as well, which you have to sort of make your own fun a bit more. You can't just, and I'm living in a city now, so I notice it with my kids now that they want to go off to, they want to go off and go to the shops around here. And I don't like that actually. I like the feeling of rural life where you have to get a bit bored and you have to go and kind of make something for yourself outside.
Yeah.
But we had a really, really lovely childhood and my dad was away during the week and my mum was around all week and she was just constantly there. I had a very, 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 very close relationship with her and was very, very loved by her. And that's what I try and give to my kids now, is that sense of like you are loved. And I think really, you know, it doesn't ultimately, my eldest son is 23, my daughter's 20 and I've got 3 much younger children. And I have learned that much more than making them eat their vegetables or which school they go to or what activities they do, how much revision they do, none of that really makes that much difference. I genuinely don't think that makes that much difference. And you can't really force somebody to work who's not going to, but loving them really, really profoundly and communicating that love and belief in them is so important. So that's what we had. And it was really beautiful. And I feel quite, I always feel sad when I talk about it because it ended. So
yeah, well, I mean, your mother sounds like a woman with zest for life and someone who loved family and children, the chaotic messiness that comes with it, and a woman sort of that lived to the fullest. It sounds like you now look at that time as magic. And I'm going to go on to talk about your mother, but we were also touching before this podcast began on that magic. Is it the way that we're looking back at it? Or do you think that when you look at your children and compare it to our, childhoods and good childhoods, you know, not everyone is blessed with a good childhood, that you worry about the differences that we've got?
Of course. I mean, it's impossible not to pick up your phone or look outside at the world and feel anxious about everything that's going on. And I don't need to list what those anxieties are here. They're so obvious to all of us globally, what's happening. And yet I also, so there's that worry, but what can you do about it? I think the thing that you can do about it is try and affect your small localized world around you and try and make the right decisions in the way that you live and the way that you are part of community and the way that you, your consumer decisions, I suppose, that you make as well. And also in terms of, I'm trying to bring the kids up to be decent human beings as well. And I think that my anxiety can spiral out of control so quickly about the environment or global stability or AI. You know, there's so, where do you start with all the different worries
yes,
that there
absolutely.
Are? I think that we should also be aware that, before us, I've often think, well, what would it have been like being a mum at the beginning of the Second World War?
I literally was thinking this as you were talking, or even before that, you know, take it another 100 years before that. Yeah, absolutely. Mm. What are we thinking as we do as humans, that we have it worse or that we're the best, which is normally our sort of way, but just take yourself back 200 years, maybe actually exactly the same conversation was happening, but these things were really life and death, or they were, you know, you literally didn't have the progression that we've got today. It's interesting.
Definitely. And when you think about healthcare, for example, and being a woman, you know, even 100 years ago, you know, the likelihood of your children dying, for example, and I think it's very easy to think, oh, we're living in this terrible time and everything is precarious. But actually, we are incredibly privileged, and there is much which is stable and beautiful and positive. And there are, you know, intelligent, good people working on climate solutions, for example. I often think about that, because the Second World War feels, I know to my kids, the Second World War seems a long time ago, but when I was growing up in the late, I was born in 75, so like I can sort of remember my mum talking about it in the early 80s, and she'd been a child in the war, so she'd had rationing and stuff. You know, it was all really very, very recent, basically, wasn't it?
Yeah, it's not long ago. Our grandparents...
I was born in 77.
Exactly. So our grandparents were there. Mm. And it's something that our children don't have that ability, do they? Or actually we tend to forget. Tell me, I had the most amazing pleasure of interviewing your sister Emma Bridgewater a few years ago. And I have to say that between you, Emma, and your dear sister Nell, who I had hoped to interview, we were actually in conversations to interview. What an inspiring, creative, wonderful trio you are, if you think about that. Tell me, how did your mum manage to raise such three incredibly strong, creative women? Because it isn't normal.
I really think that it was love that I always go back to. Mm. I think that kind of sense of giving children a feeling that they can be anything. Mum wasn't like massively ambitious. She'd much rather I stayed at home and went riding than went to school, for example. she didn't push up. My dad pushed us academically. He really pushed me and Nell academically. And he really wanted us to go to get really educated and go to a good university. And he made it clear that was kind of expected of us. Whereas mum was much more about nurture and love. And I think that has really, you know, stood all of us in good stead. I also think that what happened to my mom was really, really motivating for us. I mean, I think the thing that kind of unites us all possibly is so when I was 16, mum had this kind of beautiful childhood that I had ended literally in the course of a single day. Because when I was 16, mum had an accident on her horse and she was in a coma for several months and she was left profoundly brain damaged, unable to walk or talk or care for herself. But she was alive and she went into a nursing home where she was for the next 20 years. So I was 16 to late 30s. Mum was alive, but very, very brain damaged. And that was a very odd place of continual grief, really, because she was so altered and so very damaged by the accident. She didn't know who I was. She couldn't talk. She couldn't look after herself. She was doubly incontinent. She had numerous health issues. So you go from having a really, really loving, present mother to a mother who is still alive and yet very, very damaged. And that kind of left me, I think, with a searching, a kind of yearning, a longing for something. And I think that my work has definitely been about trying to understand what that longing and yearning is. And I think that we all have it in us whether it's, for me, it was that massive tragedy, but we all have it in some way or another. And I feel profoundly lucky that I had 16 years, because some people don't get any years of that kind of love. So I know, even though what happened to mum was absolutely horrific and it went on and on and on.
Yes.
In a way,
yes.
It took me a long time to admit this, but if she had died, it would have been better for her And it certainly would have been better for all of us. But there was sort of ongoing trauma and tragedy of her life and of her brain damage. And I think that in my writing, I'm always kind of trying to understand her. And my first book is called The Wild Other. And it was about what happened to her in my life after that and how I reacted by kind of taking myself into quite dangerous, wild situations and kind of adventuring, really. And
yes.
And in my writing, I'm just starting my fifth book, which, and they're all memoirs. And I think that they're all about big emotion. And whether that's grief or motherhood or moving house, or the new one that I'm working on is going to be about commitment and sex and relationships. It's all about kind of trying to understand the yearning that is at the heart of being a human being.
Yeah. Gosh. You know? I literally, you're like poetry. Literally, I just could just sit and you're like, you're like a car map in my ear. I'm just listening to you. As you said, so, you know, your mum's condition didn't improve. And instead of going off to uni, like you said, and you planned to go off and you travelled and you lived in a horse-drawn wagon in Ireland and for a few years before living in Texas, riding in rodeos and working on a ranch. I mean, this is like, it's sounding a bit Yellowstone there. Tell me about this time there, because it feels romantic. And I know that there was that sort of the rave scene and it was, you were finding yourself. What was that your version of going off the rails? Did you need to have that release?
Yeah, I think, so I was 16 and it was the early 90s when mum had her accident and my sister Nell was 2 years older than me. And I got through my A-levels and I did actually go to university, but I spent 2 years before that living in a wagon and raving a lot. And then straight after I went off to Texas. And I think that time, I mean, I personally think the 90s and raving, it was good fun. It was amazing partying. But I do think that as well, there was a kind of cracking open of, I mean, I know this sounds like a bit of a cliche, but like a cracking open of kind of consciousness that was really, really important. I think that the 90s brought to a certain degree some breaking down of barriers between people and social barriers. Mm-hmm. And I was aware of that. And I was felt very lucky to be part of it. I mean, obviously this came on the, you know, after the 80s when there had been more emphasis on money making and kind of like that whole
shoulder pads
and the 80s, you know, the sort of 80s idea of accumulation. And then the 90s, there was, yeah, I do think it was like an opening, a kind of heart opening. And I do think that ecstasy and raving had a big part to that, to do with that. And for me, it came at a moment in my life when my heart was broken, basically, and I was very open. And I think it enabled me to escape the reality of what was happening to my mum, and it enabled me a kind of freedom. I loved being at parties in the countryside with a fire and a big sound system and watching the sunrise. All of that appealed to, I was never into clubbing, for example. I didn't like the idea of having to go and look really good and go inside. I wanted to be outside. I wanted to be able to get muddy, and it didn't matter. And also nobody had phones, so nobody took it. There were no photographs.
Yes, there was no guilt. God, can you imagine now? I just think about that with my son. I'm sure you do. Mm. Like, there is a record, literally, of your night before. It's just, this is no fun whatsoever. These experiences you've had are quite extraordinary, and you were so young already, you know, living in these different places. I read that you said about that time, my mother's accident, you know, forced me to be brave. Is that how you felt at the time? I mean, obviously hindsight, we've matured, we've become wiser. Or do you think that most of us can only look back in retrospect and say that? Did you feel it at the time? Did you know what you were doing sort of subconsciously?
I think in my early 20s, I went off and lived in Texas, and I had this idea that I wanted to go and do something really, really physical and push myself physically. And it's interesting living in America now, actually, remembering what I did as a young woman, which was to come out here and get a Greyhound bus all over the States, really looking for a ranch that would take me on, because I was a good rider, you know, growing up with horses, and I wanted to go and live on a ranch and kind of live a out on the plains and be wild and find out about cowboys. And I was obviously like an attraction to the whole idea of cowboys, because who isn't attracted to cowboys, basically? But also there was no Instagram. So I remember thinking, I want to find out if cowboys are real. Obviously you can go on Instagram and now follow tons of cowboys, but literally it was a voyage of discovery. And as a young English woman, talking your way onto a ranch in Texas is a very hard thing to do, definitely. And when I was out in the, I was out in California last week thinking, God, I was like 23, 24, and I was 22, 23 when I was traveling around here on my own, just walking onto these places. And I worked in two incredible ranches, and it was very, very remote, very hard work. Definitely met a lot of cowboys, had an incredible time, rode bucking horses and rodeos, had a really, and when I look back on it now, I can see that I was brave. And I think there were some things that I knew that I was doing. I knew that I was taking myself to a place of extremes. I don't think I could have identified bravery necessarily, but I knew
but
that
maybe
I was
extremes,
doing something.
Yeah. Pushing yourself out of your comfort zone completely.
I knew that what I was doing was quite dangerous, and I wanted it to be quite dangerous. And it was almost, I think it was like a way of, because mum's accident just went on and on and on. It was this like ongoing trauma that never ended. I think for me, I wanted to face the trauma and like not let the trauma get it's the better of me, as it were, and say like, I'm going to win this and I'm going to get on this crazy bucking horse in the middle of West Texas. I mean, when I think about it now, I think, oh my God, like the risks I took.
But I'm pleased if your kids said it to you now, would you be like, okay, hang on a second.
I know, it seems wild. And then I came back from Texas, and then I immediately, like straight away, got pregnant. I had a child at 24. So it was all, I can see now that I was living to real extremes. And I think that, and you know, Nell went and started a circus.
She did.
At home,
I mean,
being quiet. Either.
The best circus there ever was. I think, you know, this resilience, I think you're talking, you build when you go through trauma. And obviously we know people, and it does inevitably change you. And maybe it does make you braver and more courageous. We can maybe look at it on the other side of these moments, this empathetic ability that we get, or the gratefulness. And your podcast is called Tiny Acts of Bravery. And you've spoken about being brave, but what does being brave look like to you? And is it different for everybody? Or have you seen some common denominators?
I think it is different for everybody, and the way that we're sort of tested, you know, for some people, and I know certainly, and I'm talking for myself right now, there are moments when bravery has been about just, you know, I've been through periods of depression. And when you're depressed, properly depressed, then just getting up and getting the kids to school and walking through the day and then making supper and getting them to bed is a really brave thing to do. And I think, and then there are other moments when bravery is about packing up my entire life and moving out here to America, which, as I say, has been a much harder than I thought it would be. Or, you know, so Nell died, when my sister died in 2019, facing the year after her death, getting up and making my life was required, you know, real courage. And those are the ways that I have been tested. But I see bravery in other people. And I think that bravery often comes down to that kind of determination to keep going, you know, to keep
living
forward. Yeah. And to keep, when you see people going through really, really tough things and finding joys or pleasures in something, you know, something quite small. In 2017, my husband had a terrible, terrible accident, and he was caught up in one of the terrorist things that was going on in London at that time, and he broke both his legs really, really badly, and he was in a wheelchair for a long time, and he was in a profound pain. And I remember on Christmas Day, he'd been in hospital for a month, and he couldn't, I mean, his legs were in a terrible state. And I remember on Christmas Day, I managed to get him out of this hospital bed he'd been in and wheel him into the kitchen, and he said, oh, this is really nice, isn't it? And I remember Nell, my sister, who was actually really ill at the time with cancer, saying, Pete's really brave, isn't he? And that sort of like, that kind of, the sort of sweetness, I suppose, of him going, oh, this is really nice, even though he couldn't couldn't walk, didn't know if he was going to be able to walk again, of kind of appreciating a little moment and finding that localized joy, even when there is a lot of big traumatic stuff going on, is a kind of, you know, a kind of bravery.
On Conversations of Inspiration, I only ever invite on guests with a fascinating story to tell and who aren't afraid to go there. People brave enough to be vulnerable and share that life isn't always as shiny as it appears, and show that to become successful, we have to experience some tremendous downs as well as the ups. Because isn't that ultimately what gets us where we need to go? It's also why I've built my marketplace this way. Yes, you'll find thoughtful gifts for birthdays, anniversaries, and special occasions like Mother's Day, for example. But I also wanted to create a place where you could shop not just by department, but through emotion. The moments in life we don't always share with the world. A place that helps you celebrate the huge milestones, but also helps you find the words or the right gift when darkness creeps in and you just don't know what to say. It's also why we celebrate people's niches, those funny things about us that makes us just us. Whether you know someone who really is into wild swimming, or who's passionate about birds, or just happens to love Monster Munch, like me. If this sounds like an interesting way to shop, head to holly.co to explore. Now, back to our conversation of inspiration.
I'm going to go back to your story, because you mentioned that after leaving Texas, you headed home and you were quite quickly married, and you had to your first husband, and you became a mother for the first time, and you were so young. You were creating maybe that comfort, maybe that stability in your family. Is that the time that you started writing your first book, My Wild and Sleepless Nights?
I had my son Jimmy when I was 24, and I didn't really know what I wanted to do, but I kind of started when I was in Texas. I'd been writing a bit, and then I started writing, and I was asked to write for a magazine about having been a cowgirl in Texas. And then I was asked to write about, so I went to university in Oxford, so I was asked to write about having gone to Oxford and then had a baby straight
being
after.
Being a cowgirl in Oxford.
I thought this is quite a nice way to like make, you know, a few hundred quid. Yeah. I can be at home and I can do some writing.
It's a freelancing thing. It's quite good.
Freelancing, yeah. And so then I started working very hard, writing for trade magazines, like writing for any. And I was also teaching English as a foreign language. I was working in a bookshop. I was living on very, very little money and kind of cobbling together little bits of writing work. But I was quite good at it, and I worked hard at it, and I learned how to write to deadline and turn stuff over, and I developed my voice, which sort of started to become more about who I was asked a lot about my own experiences, and I worked as a journalist all the way through my 20s. I split up with the children's dad, so I was on my own. And actually, you know, people talk about the pram and the hall, but for me, motherhood has been massively, massively motivating, and it's stopped me from just, you know, wasting my time mucking around doing, I mean, I still wasted my time mucking around having a laugh, but I had two kids to support.
Yes.
So I was
gets
like,
you focused.
It really, really got me focused. And I didn't have any money, so I couldn't really afford loads of childcare. I just kind of started writing, and I didn't stop. And I wrote two novels in my 20s and 30s, which are unpublished, but which was also really hard to deal with. That was really hard, those books being rejected. But I knew that I wanted to kind of write about what happened to Mum, and after she died in my late 30s, that was when I actually wrote my first book, which is The Wild Other, which is about Mum. But and then straight after that, I wrote My Wild and Sleepless Nights, which is about motherhood, because I was really interested. People said, oh, you're so brave. You went off to Texas. You did all this crazy stuff. You would like spend loads of time in southern Russia. And like, you were so wild and brave. And at that time I'd met my second husband, and I had three more children. I was actually pregnant with my fifth child at that time. And I remember thinking, going off and traveling the world and having the adventures that involves is not as brave as being a mother staying at home And people always think this is funny, but it's not really meant as funny, with a baby and a toddler and a preschooler, because that takes courage. That takes resilience. That takes personal resources of tenacity kindness and patience. And you know, you're exhausted and you have to keep going. And so that's what I wanted to write about motherhood, what it really, really feels like, and how it takes you from a place of like really quite bleak depression, in my experience, to a really high, you know, highs of the most extreme love and joy. And I found it really interesting writing My World and Sleepless Nights, because it is about motherhood and nothing particularly happens. My fifth child, Lester, is born. My eldest child, Jimmy, was at that stage in adolescence, and an adolescent boy, and he was like smashing into adolescent life in the way that adolescent boys do, and into loads of trouble. So I sort of wrote about walking along beside him through that and supporting him through it. And it was very interesting just writing about pure emotion in a way, you know, about the experience of motherhood. And it's been really wonderful on when I do events or on Instagram, wherever, people say, you know, the way that you wrote about motherhood really enabled me to love being a mother, enabled me to know that I wasn't mad because I hated it, or enabled me to realize that it was okay, it was normal to have intrusive thoughts, and that postnatal depression wasn't anything to be ashamed of. You know, your openness has made me feel less ashamed about my conflicted feelings about motherhood.
It's just an amazing, I mean, you know, recently talking to mums with little ones, and I have an office full of women who have various ages of children. And, you know, honestly, to be a mum in this day and age, to be a working mum in this day and age, to be this sort of having it all, you know, we talk about this having it all, and the worst, I think one of the worst things that anyone could have ever said, trying to do all of this in this modern day, having young children, maybe being alone, travelling husbands, whatever it is, it can be the most crushing lonely points in your life. Lonely physically, lonely, but lonely in your soul. You know, it's a very dark time. And I think actually, you know, being parents is quite a, you know, parenting doesn't stop, or learning how to be a parent doesn't stop. I'm finding that quite difficult, you know, how to let go, how to empower but advise, how to, I don't know, I'm finding that almost as difficult as maybe younger years. It's just a how are you coping with your two being at university?
Oh, it's, I mean, because I'm here in America, I find it really hard. I miss the kind of sense that I wouldn't go and see them. You know, my son's at Manchester, my daughter Dolly is at university in the south of England. I wouldn't go there all the time, but just knowing that I could be there, yes, if they need be, is, I really miss that feeling. I really miss them. I mean, I really love them. They're great company. And I miss the kind of the sweetness as well of having elder children coming home, and then the younger children just love it so much.
I can imagine.
But I also think, and Dolly and I talk about this a lot, that Dolly has really grown and matured in ways that if I'd been living in England still, she probably would have been coming home a lot more. And it's kind of forced, you know, we're talking about growth earlier, it's sort of forced a growth as well, which is hard at the time, and a kind of resilience, which has been, you know, really, really valuable to her as well. But I do, straightforwardly, I miss them a lot. And I couldn't live abroad. I couldn't live here long term. I don't want to set up a life where I'm in a different country to, yes, them, you know. I mean, they may go off and who knows, yes, you know, you can't control your children, but like having grown up children is such a joy, and the kind of relationships that I have with them. And I've been through hard times with the kids, been through hard times. I was a single mother for 10 years to them both. And then when Jimmy was in his adolescence, you know, it's rocky. It's difficult. And your relationship changes and evolves. But having that, I mean, one of the things I'm most proud of is a feeling that I'm close to my children, and they know that they're really, really loved, and they know that they can rely on me, and they know that I have totally, totally believe in them, whatever, you know, whatever's going on. And I think that that's a continual,
yes,
thing that we have to communicate,
absolutely,
you know, and have a much, you know what, your late teens, early 20s, you stumble, you fall, you make, take the wrong turnings, you're experimenting. And I think as a parent, like sort of plodding along beside them and saying, I'm here for you, and I believe in you, is really important.
Just a constant that is never, ever going to go, you know. And I think that is that backbone, that net. Whenever you fall, I will be here to catch you, whatever age you are. I think is a blessing that we don't talk about enough, and so many people don't have that. And I've witnessed what that can do to them as adults and throughout their life, not having that. You mentioned, and I'm so sorry that your mum passed away 22 years after her accident, and I can only imagine the complicated emotions of almost losing her one time and then losing her again. And then I'm sorry that, deeply sorry that you lost your sister Nell to breast cancer in 2019. And I don't actually know really what to say. Words are not enough to say how sorry I am for those tragedies. Your book, The Red of My Blood, was written as you navigated that first gut-wrenching and terrible, painful year. Your words are so raw and touch so deeply. Was writing the book a way that you could face your emotions about death and loss? Can you share with us?
I think that, I don't think you can understand death, but I think bringing a narrative around death into your daily life is really important, to talk about it with yourself, with your children. One of the things that Mum's accident taught me was that you think that the bad stuff that happens, the losses, the deaths, the tragedies, are a sign of life having gone really, really wrong in some way or another. But actually, like, understanding they are life. That is like what happens. Mm. And it's a very, very, very difficult thing to kind of take on and process. But the more that we sort of think about it, and I talk with my kids really quite a lot about death, to try and, I mean, nothing's going to prepare you really for the moment that when someone you love is really, really gone. But a kind of sense of, this is what happens, and this is how we can remember each other, and this is the joy that we can have here and now. And we talk about Nell a lot and kind of remember her a lot. And then we also are trying to teach them about enjoying their lives and appreciating what they have here while they are alive, but holding that fact of the kind of darkness and the light at the same time, I think is really, really important. And I think that we're so scared of talking about death. I mean, I think it's getting a bit better. I think on Instagram, it's very interesting on Instagram, because there are kind of many grief groups and people. But then when you talk with your friends about it, people are more scared by actually confronting it and discussing it. So I think bringing it to the table is a really important thing to do. And it's doing a favor, because we're all, to everybody around you who loves you, so that when you do die, you will have had a conversation about it, and you might have said something funny about it, or you might have said something which will help somebody. You know, I wish that I'd spoken to Nell more about it, but she didn't want to talk about it by the time she was diagnosed with very aggressive secondary cancer, and then it was too late. You know, it was too late to talk about it, really. And I wish that I wish we'd kind of discussed it. And what do you think about the afterlife? Do you believe in the afterlife? Do you believe in God? What do you think happens to us when we die? How do you want to remember? How do you want to be remembered? All that kind of, like, what is your beliefs? And it actually leads to a really kind of lively, interesting conversation with children as well. And it makes the idea of death
not finite,
and a little bit less like this, you know, dark,
untouchable,
black,
do not speak,
figure of
yes,
death, yeah, in the corner,
Voldemort,
and yeah, exactly, and the kind of the angel of death type of figure. It kind of reduces that a bit. And when we were in England, we would go to Nell's grave and have a picnic, and sometimes the kids would like be really emotional, or sometimes they'd just like be kids, you know, knocking each other over and arguing over who was going to like have the last bit of orange juice or whatever it was. And that kind of made it, brought death around us, I think, a bit more. And I think that's healthy. It's healthy. It's difficult to do. And I also, you know, I sometimes just wake up thinking, oh my God, I'm going to die and everybody I love is going to die. And that's a terrible, terrible thing to realize. And yet that is life. You know, that is that's it.
And that's why it's so precious. And that's for those who might not know now, I definitely do and admire her greatly. Just briefly tell us what she did with her extraordinary life.
She was extraordinary, and growing up together was an extreme experience. She was so from when we were little, she was really obsessed by the circus, and she used to like create little circuses, and also she was an artist. So when she finished university, she went off and she worked in circuses, like living in little vans and selling popcorn and riding ponies. And she was really, which is what I am too. We were both really determined. And I think our childhood gave us that kind of determination. And she started her own circus. And for her, the art and creativity of the circus was really, really important. The kind of vision, the artistic vision of it. And I think that people often saw it as this sort of glittering, glorious, you know, entertainment. But actually, there's very serious messages about death, actually, in that circus as well. And she did that with such, rich creativity. But she was also a very serious person. And people think because she had a circus, she was kind of really out there and wild. But actually, she was really, really serious and quite shy and magnificent and difficult and wonderful person and a very funny person. And I really miss her. I really miss, because she's the only person, our elder siblings are, I'm very close to them, but they're older. And so Nell and I were the ones that grew up together as kids. You know, we slept in the same bedroom, had our baths together, went off on our little childhood adventures together. And when your sibling dies, there is nobody who has shared that experience with you. And so there is a kind of strange and agonizing severing of your childhood. And it's almost like your childhood, did it happen? You know, it becomes a kind of, so talk about looking backwards with, it just becomes this really, really magical place. And I really miss being able to just, you know, we had a difficult relationship with sisters, and she was a big, big, difficult person. And we argued a lot, but we would then pick things up and start talking again straight away. And I really miss being able to talk to her about things that nobody else gets, nobody else understands, nobody else. There's just nobody else that I can talk to who, and I'm really, really, really close to my husband, but he wasn't there in my childhood, obviously. So there are things that, however much he engages with me and loves me and I love him, like there are just things that only Nell understood. And I miss that. I just miss that. It's agonizing. You know, it's really, really, really painful.
I can't imagine. My best friend is my sister, and we've built Notting High Street and Holly & Co. together and worked together for nearly 20 years. And so I have no ability to sort of go there slightly, just because it would be as, you know, a right arm being taken off or worse. With Gifford Circus still continuing, do you think that lives in her memory, in that people get to experience it still with her, with the fact she created such a magical thing?
Yeah, I mean, it's complex. That's a really complex question, because for me, I remember the circus as she created it, because I think that she had a total originality and magic that went with her. There was that there was something about the circus embodied by her that couldn't, you know, that it kind of, yeah, it yeah. left when she left. And
when I look at our the funeral parade for her, oh gosh, you know, that's again where you talk about being open and talking about our deaths and how we want to be remembered. And I think about her legacy. I think about even that final moment was so her. it was unbelievable.
Definitely. She was, you know, she was really unlike other people. She wasn't really, I have a son called, one of my sons is quite other. And Nell once said about him, Dash is like a whole other new kind of human being. And in a way, Nell was like her. Like, she was unlike... There's nobody really like... I've never met anybody like Nell. I mean, she was completely maddening as well. She could be really, really difficult and totally unreasonable and very self-interest, you know, self-regard. Like, she was into what was going on in her own life as a true artist, I think,
right.
is,
yes.
basically. But she was extraordinary and yeah, and her funeral was... It was at Gloucester Cathedral. It was really an incredible... spectacle. It was, yeah, it was totally her, and it's a big loss, and grief rearranges things in life as well. The kind of, I don't know, there's a things happen in grief that you don't expect. There's more levels of loss in terms of the way people communicate and interact, and I found it really hard. I found like the way family life has been rearranged, relationships with some of my friends who I thought were rock solid have kind of floated away. And I think people find grief really, I mean, it amazes me that this is the case, but people find the grieving person difficult and dangerous almost because you're in such an extreme place. And I suppose Nell's death has also made me think about the way that life, it changed, you know. Sometimes I'm walking around Washington, D.C., thinking 4 years ago, Nell was still alive and I was living in Oxfordshire. And then 4 years later, I'm living in Washington, D.C. She's dead. She never even knew that I came to America. I always find that fact really, really, you know, life has changed totally from a way that I couldn't have conceived of it. And that's what we were talking about earlier in the interview, is like, how do you, you know, what is bravery? In a way, that knowledge that there will be change. It might not be change that you want, or, you know, I can't say that I've loved living in America, but it has brought change and a kind of regeneration and new horizons and new ways to kind of challenge my creativity.
I have worked with Dell Technologies for many years because they truly do believe in supporting small businesses. They recognise that a fear of tech is one of the leading blockers to founders scaling their brands. And through their initiative, Dell for Startups, you'll have access to your very own tech advisor. Yes, all for free, who will support you to plan and identify all your tech needs at every stage of your journey. They also recognise that for many small businesses, visibility is one of the biggest challenges they face when they're trying to reach new customers. So each week, Dell give away their ad break space. Now over to this week's winner of Dell's independent ad break.
Hello, I'm Charlotte Giddings, the very proud co-founder of Brownie and the Bean Bakery. We're a family-run bakery based on the Norfolk-Suffolk borders, and we are absolutely passionate about people and connections. Every single aspect of our brownies and blondies is handcrafted, from pralines to jams, sauces and much, much more. We're also incredibly passionate about supporting other small businesses along our journey. That's why you'll find that our flour is made from Norfolk-grown wheat, and we also get our eggs and sugar locally in Suffolk. If you love all things handcrafted and hand-baked, head to our website, which is www.brownieandthebean.com. There you'll find our range of beautifully handcrafted cakes and bakes to send to loved ones all across the United Kingdom. We know you're going to love them just as much as we love making them. Thank you so much for listening.
Thank you, Dell, for your support and generosity. If you'd like to find out more about Dell for Startups and connect with your very own personal tech advisor, or you just like to be in with your chance to have your very own ad on here in this series, head to holly.co/Dell. Now, let's get back to conversations of inspiration. I have loved talking to you. Can I ask you, tell me, what are your hopes and dreams for now?
For now, I love being with my family, you know. We've my children and my husband. And I also love my life as a writer. And if I can go on creating a life where there's strength and there's creativity and there's love all together, then that's That's what I want. And I like being here in America and I like the adventure of it. But I do also look forward to being back in England in the countryside. 3 years time. Yeah, exactly. But I know that I will go back to that as well with having changed and having grown. And I'm excited by the idea of being back there. But I feel like I'm becoming more and more creative. I'm really interested by that. I'm 48 years old and I feel like my life is kind of becoming harder but richer. It's becoming more and more interesting. And, you know, there is so much loss in it. And yet there is so much growth and there is so much kind of possibility. And the wild beauty of life, it's extraordinary. I stopped drinking nearly 3 years ago. And I've also found that really, really fascinating about the ability to enable me to really experience this extraordinary privilege, extraordinary gift of life and being, you know, being a human being. And I think, I feel optimistic. I feel optimistic despite the losses. I feel really optimistic.
And it's amazing, isn't it? At 48, and I've just turned 47, and I actually feel at the peak of my creativity in my life. I've never felt more me, more empowered, and the adventure ahead of me. You know, heaven forbid, feeling like sort of I'm done. I sort of feel like I haven't begun. Are you feeling that's your future?
100%. I'm so curious about what the next bit of life holds in store. I love the feeling of aging, of becoming older, and the kind of massive, massive privilege that it affords simply by being alive, but also the kind of knowledge, you know, the knowledge that has come to me through over the last few decades. What else is lying ahead of me? And I know sometimes that's an intimidating thought, because you know there's also going to be massive challenges and loss and sadness, and yet there will also be beautiful, extraordinary places which you will, you know, go literally and creatively. And I think creativity, I feel more deeply creative than I've ever felt. I'm just starting my fifth book, my new book, which is the one that is about home, and that's coming out now. And I know with that book, I really pushed myself harder than I've ever pushed myself, and I took my writing to new places. And I'm really excited by what I can express and communicate, and how I can connect with other people in my writing. And the kind of, I know that for me, the thing that makes me feel better in life is work. I know that when I go into my workplace and achieve stuff and express stuff, it's hard, but I love the feeling of it. And so, yeah, I do. I totally agree with you. I feel like I'm in a good place and very positive about the future.
And everyone can pre-order. Am I right in saying this? Is that right? The Giant on the Skyline, which is the book that you're referring to, is available to pre-order now?
It's available to pre-order now, and pre-orders help the life of that book so much. I'm always very, very grateful. It's out on the 8th of May, and it's about home and landscape and longing. It's also about kind of melancholy and nostalgia and motherhood and a little bit about midlife and what home really, really means and what it feels like. And I'm so excited to share that with people.
I cannot wait. I've learned so much from you today. I can't thank you enough. And I'm wondering if you would do us the honour of sharing a letter to your younger self.
I absolutely will. Thank you so much, Holly. It's been a real joy talking to you. And all these conversations, you know, these kind of conversations are so important to be part of. And I know that I certainly listen to your podcast, and I listen to lots of podcast recordings. That thing of the stuff that we can learn from one another is so valuable, isn't it? So it's been lovely.
Thank you so very much. Such an honour. I hand over to you.
A big, strange, difficult, beautiful life is lying ahead for you. And at this point, right at the start, I want you to believe in yourself, and I want you to believe in an inner strength you possess, which is going to take you through. because this strength is your superpower. Listen to me. You have a towering strength inside you, although you probably won't feel it yet. In fact, you probably feel the opposite of it right now, because this strength is something that life is going to reveal to you as you walk through it. And in order to find that strength, you will have to experience great loss and the darkest, blackest tragedy that will feel so terrible, you'll sometimes question your ability to survive. But take that strength hiding inside you and know that an incredible life is awaiting for you. I'm telling you this now because I want you to know that when that loss and tragedy hits you, it doesn't mean that your life has gone wrong. Understanding that loss is at the center of life is a profoundly important lesson, which will help you keep going when you feel broken. And that life of yours is stretched out before you like an unexplored valley, which you'll cross. That valley of your life is full of harmonious, gorgeous, bright green pastures, which you will stroll through, astonished by the beauty of your surroundings. But in that valley are also sheer, dark rock faces with no footholds, swathed in darkness and mist, which will look insurmountable, terrifying, and absolutely hostile. There will be many, many rock faces like this. And when you cross them, and you will, you'll start to learn that valley, which is your life, is both outstandingly beautiful and terrifyingly bleak and hard. This is how life is. The beauty and the terror exist alongside one another almost all the time. As you walk on through your life, you'll learn how to hold and appreciate those two facts at the same time. Life is really, really difficult and absolutely extraordinary. At first, this will feel like a strange trick, but as you walk further into that valley, you'll get better at allowing yourself to feel the beauty of every day at the same time that you're absorbing the pain of loss, which will sometimes feel like it's going to consume you. But I want you to learn from that pain, because it's in that loss and that tragedy, and there will be many in your young life that you'll really find yourself, and you will find that strength I've told you about. I want you to try to inhabit the days and to feel the outer edges of yourself within them. Do not rush. Life moves fast, but there's also plenty of time. So allow yourself to get lost. And when you find yourself falling to your knees in despair, just surrender to it for a bit. Then gather your strength and walk on. Also know that there is no better place where these days of your life is leading. No easy destination you'll find a bit later down the life when you've achieved this or done that or got that. Life is now. And it's happening to you at this moment. This is it, here in your hands right now. There are other things that are important to know about other people, because your relationship with other people will help you so much in life and be a source of such joy and consolation. So reach for the truth in the way you communicate with other people. Be honest and do not lie. Earning the trust of others is important, as it's the currency of human communication. Take an interest in other people. Ask them their stories. Listen to what they have to say. Become a good listener, since the power of true and open human communication is exquisite and will teach you so much about life. Give your time to other people. Be curious and share your story with other people too. Be open. Treat people well and kindly, but do not measure your success against theirs. The valley of their life they are walking through is completely unlike your own, so comparing your route to theirs will achieve nothing. Instead, concentrate on your own path. Take time to look around you at the bright green valley you'll sometimes find yourself in. where a sparkling river meanders across a meadow, and take time to enjoy it. Feel the good moments when they're happening. Rejoice in your good luck to find yourself in such a peaceful, easy place, and store that memory inside you to sustain you and push you onwards. When the valley changes and you reach that steep rock face, stumbling to find your footing, crying that you are lost, that you want to give up. Because you can keep going if you are calm. Keep going and be calm. Learn the habit of not panicking, but instead turning your fear into tenacity and courage. You have so much courage inside you. You're such a brave person with so much appetite for invention and creativity. But these are things that won't come to you straight away. You'll have to work for them. You'll have to push yourself on. Take your life seriously. Take your creativity seriously. Have fun and acknowledge each good moment when it's there, but work hard. You'll find yourself in work, and it will be a source of rich joy and absolute solace. And more than anything, learn that love is an active verb. Love openly and communicate your love as often as you can to the people who matter to you. You are strong, but allow yourself to be vulnerable too. Allow yourself to be loved and learn that you can love right back. Show the people you love, those that really matter to you, how much you care for them, not just in words, but how you cherish them too. Love will show the extraordinary way that life renews itself. And love, more than anything, is where you will find your greatest joy. So go out. Your life is waiting. It's going to be so hard. It's going to be so bright and brilliant. Keep going.
I'm here and I'm a mess. I can't thank you enough for sharing that.
Sorry.
For sharing that. Your ability to be so authentic, so poetic, so eloquent, so beautiful in the way that you communicate. You talked about communication being one of the most important things, and I've really rarely been in front of someone who can communicate the way you have. And I don't think I'll ever think of life not like a valley anymore. And the way you just have brought that to life, and I am so deeply sorry for your losses in your life. I can't imagine. But you have really, really taught us that holding the two things simultaneously is something that we should learn from this podcast. And I'm going to actively try and do that. And I have you to thank for that. And I can't thank you enough for being so beautifully you today. So thank you so much for joining us.
It's been a real honour, and reading that letter was very, very powerful and very helpful to me. And I'm grateful for the invitation to share it with you. So and to have this conversation. Thank you very, very much.
Thank
Holly.
You very much, you. Okay. Thank you for joining me today. If you've enjoyed this episode, can I ask that you share it with a friend and like, subscribe and review it too, so that together we can inspire even more people to follow their dreams to build a life they love.